Welcome back. In this lecture, we're going to look at the various ways in which the Greek and Latin language coexisted beside each other, while often serving rather different purposes. It's worth noting at the start that Greek is the oldest of all the European languages, with a continuous history lasting 3,300 years. Ecclesiastical Latin continues to be used by the Roman Catholic Church to this day, notably in the form of the Tridentine Mass, which was codified by the Council of Trent in the 16th century. In addition, medieval Latin, not the same quite as ecclesiastical Latin, evolved out of classical Latin and became the language used by all educated people, scientists, physicians, lawyers, and so forth, in Europe right up until the 18th century. A famous literary example is Newton's three-volume Principia Mathematica, published in 1687, which, being in Latin, was thus accessible to the entire European scientific community. What we call the Romance languages, namely Italian, French, Spanish, Portuguese, and Romanian, only very slowly and at very different rates began to evolve out of Latin into regional, or as we would say, national variants. The earliest stage of French, known as Roman, began to evolve, for instance, in the 8th century. The transformation of Latin into the Romance languages was brought about by the eruption of Germanic tribes into the empire from the 4th century onwards. The immigrants took over Latin and adapted it to their tongue. The fact that Latin survived as the basis of the Romance languages was wholly due to the fact that the immigrants arrived in waves and did not overwhelm the Latin speakers. In other parts of the Western Empire, such as Britain, Latin was completely wiped out. This lecture is not, however, merely about language, as if that isn't a big enough issue by itself. It's also about power, not only political power, but also cultural power. Think of the line from Horace that we encountered in the previous lecture. Greece, the captive, made her savage victor captive. One of the ways in which the Greeks captured the Romans was through their language, which, along with its literary heritage, every single Greek speaker who ever lived considered to be immeasurably superior to any other language, including, it goes without saying, Latin. What gave the claim credibility in Greek eyes was, number one, the sheer antiquity of the Greek language, and number two, the richness of its literary tradition. As we saw, Greek was already being spoken in the second half of the second millennium BC, as we know from Linear B, the syllabic script used by the Mycenaeans. In the 8th century BC, when Homer was composing, literary Greek was already highly sophisticated. Homer composed in an artificial mixture of dialects that no Greek ever spoke. He used the hexameter, an extraordinarily majestic meter. Menin aedetea peleia deo achilleos, ulomenein hemuri achaiois alge etheke. The opening lines of the Iliad. Wonderful, flowing meter. Greek poetry evolved earlier than prose, but by the late 6th century, prose too had become highly sophisticated. In the 5th and 4th centuries BC, in the hands of historians such as Herodotus and Thucydides, of philosophers such as Plato, and of orators such as Demosthenes, it achieved a height of perfection never exceeded. Classical literature is written in the Attic dialect, the dialect spoken in Athens and its environ, which first came into prominence with the writing of Greek tragedy. Interestingly, the chorus in tragedy is written in the Doric dialect, perhaps because it was among the Dorian population of Greece that the art form of tragedy had its origins. We talked in an earlier lecture about the split between the Ionic, of which Attic is a subdivision, and Doric dialects, and the possibility that these reflect an ethnic divide in the Greek population. The latest literary genre to emerge was the novel, around the beginning of the Common Era, or a century or so earlier. We'll be looking at all these genres later in the course. They deserve a great deal of attention. As we noted at the very beginning of this course, the Greek language was one of the ways in which the Greeks themselves defined their Greekness, to Hellenikon being the word for Greekness. And that, of course, put the Macedonians in a bit of a bind because their language sounded so strange to a Greek ear. In fact, the Greeks debated whether the Macedonians were actually true Greeks. Unfortunately, so little of the Macedonian language has survived in writing that we don't know whether to think of it as A, simply a very strange Greek dialect, but Greek nonetheless, or B, as a separate language altogether, related to Greek, but distinct from it. It was partly to overcome this racist prejudice that Philip II made classical Attic the official language of his court. He also took other steps to increase Macedon's cultural capital by Hellenizing it, so to speak, notably by hiring Aristotle as Alexander's tutor, his son, who became Alexander the Great. And when Alexander went off to conquer the East, the language that he exported was Attic Greek, or a dialectal variant thereof known as Koine, meaning the common language, very close to Attic, which now began to replace all the pre-existing dialects in the Greek-speaking world. So the Greek cities, as they lost their independence, also lost their individual dialects and began to write and eventually to speak in Koine. The New Testament, for instance, is written in Koine. As a literary vehicle, Latin was at a severe disadvantage compared with Greek. To begin with, it developed far later than Greek. Even as late as the first half of the 2nd century BC, literary Latin was still extremely rudimentary. Things only changed in the second half of the 2nd century BC, when prose became more sophisticated and subtle, largely as the result of contact with Greek literature. However, Latin poetry didn't really attain much elegance until the late 1st century BC. Latin wasn't the only language spoken in Italy, we should note. On the contrary, many other languages, not just different dialects, but different languages, were spoken in the peninsula from time immemorial. They include Oscan, Umbrian, Ligurian, Faliscan, Celtic, especially, of course, important, Etruscan. Etruscan is attested in Italy from 700 BC to the late 1st century BC. It's peculiar in not being Indo-European. Indo-European refers to a family of languages that trace their descent from a putative common ancestor language that has not survived. There are some 90,000 inscriptions in Etruscan, but most of these are sepulchral, with proper names predominating, which means it's very difficult to get a grip on the actual structure of the language. Overall, Etruscologists get the gist of Etruscan, but there's lots too they don't understand. By the 1st century BC, however, as Rome's power and influence became more deeply embedded in the Italian peninsula, Latin began to predominate. Other Italic languages continued to be spoken as late as the 1st century CE, but eventually they disappeared altogether. However, there was never an official Roman policy of eliminating native languages. It just happened out of convenience eventually. The only non-Latin language that survived on the peninsula apart from Latin was, interestingly, Greek. And this was due to the density of Greek settlements in southern Italy as well as Sicily. It's something I'll return to at the end of this lecture. If you wanted to better yourself in the Roman world, then you needed to learn either Greek or Latin, and preferably both. Latin was the language used both by the administration and by the military. Greek, on the other hand, was the language of education and culture, not just in the East, but pretty much everywhere throughout the empire. I might add that from the 1st century BC onwards, and this is a truly astounding fact, you would have heard almost as much Greek as Latin being spoken in the streets of Rome, due to the fact that there were thousands upon thousands of Greek slaves working in the capital at that time. But though Latin and Greek predominated, they were by no means the only languages spoken in the empire. As Ramsay MacMullan has put it, once outside the cities and rich rural villas, away from Italy and Greece, a thickening accent gradually gave way mile by mile to a total ignorance of the master tongues, meaning Latin and Greek. In their stead, Aramaic, Phrygian, Arabic, Punic, Berber, and Thracian were spoken. MacMullan further claims that, I quote, to the very end, a majority of the population living in the Roman Empire must have spoken neither Latin nor Greek in their homes, whatever they spoke of necessity in the courts and marketplaces. Bilingualism, even trilingualism, was common, then as now, in cities like Beirut, Alexandria, or Marseille. Even so, it remained the case that Greek dominated in the East and Latin in the West, particularly among the educated classes. However, the only written languages that have survived from the Roman Empire, apart from Greek and Latin, are Hebrew and Coptic. And the reason for this is that they were the vehicles of two important religions, Judaism and Coptic Christianity. As in so many other areas of interaction between the two cultures, there was rivalry and tension between Greek and Latin speakers. To begin with, there was rivalry as to which was the quote-unquote superior language. Cicero, for one, held the view that Latin was inherently superior, not least because of its greater copia verborum, its greater abundance of words. Well, Cicero got it seriously wrong. Not that it would have been possible for him to get it right in the absence of anything resembling a Greek or Latin dictionary. On the basis of our modern Greek and Latin dictionaries, a very rough count would give us about 40,000 Latin words compared with about 130,000 Greek words. However, as Andrew Keller has pointed out, these numbers are approximations, in addition to which the Latin dictionary has a severely restricted time period since it stops at 200 AD. He adds, nonetheless, I always think of Greek as having at least twice the vocabulary of Latin, in part because of its ability and tendency to form compounds so easily, in part because of the tremendous length of time in which literary works were both produced and have survived. Carrying on with the comparison, Quintilian, who lived AD 35 to 90 approximately, who was an authority on rhetoric, writing a century later, therefore, conceded that Greek was more pleasant to the ear, but insisted that Latin had a superior weightiness to it. On the other hand, the emperor Marcus Aurelius chose to write his Meditations in Greek in the belief that Latin was inadequate to the task of conveying his very weighty ideas on Stoicism, a philosophical movement that originated in Greece. In general, the Greeks were reluctant to learn Latin, as they were to learn any foreign language. Why learn to speak in another tongue when there's nothing worth reading in it anyway? In the earlier period, the Romans did try to encourage the Greeks to learn Latin. Livy tells us that when, in 167 BC, the Romans abolished the monarchy in Macedon and divided the kingdom into four republics, the Roman commander, Aemilius Paulus, I quote, speaking in Latin, explained the arrangements that had been decided upon both by the Senate and by himself on the advice of 10 commissioners. And then the praetor, Gnaeus Octavius, translated what he had said into Greek. In fact, Valerius Maximus, a Roman historian writing in the reign of Tiberius, tells us that in early times, he doesn't give a date, Magistrates only ever spoke to Greeks in Latin, I quote, in order to spread the Latin tongue among all the peoples and make it more respectable. Well, even if that's true, the attention ultimately failed. Cicero tells us that when he was learning oratory, he did more exercises in Greek than in Latin, partly because the best teachers of oratory only knew Greek and so couldn't otherwise correct his mistakes. Well, we don't, of course, have any statistics to go on, but anecdotal data certainly suggest that many more Romans became bilingual than Greeks. Or perhaps those Greeks who did know Latin didn't regard their facility in the language as anything to boast about. Certainly, members of the professional classes must have had a smattering of Latin to practice medicine, say, or to teach, but it's extremely doubtful whether Latin literature made much headway into the school curriculum of Greek pupils. There are virtually no references to any Greek ever reading a Latin work, either for enjoyment or for self-improvement, although it's difficult to believe that they weren't intrigued by, say, Horace's efforts to adapt Greek poetic forms, or by Virgil's efforts to write an epic. But if they were, they've kept pretty quiet about it. It was in the 3rd century BC that the Romans first began learning to speak and write Greek. Their initial attempts seem to have been somewhat comical. There's a story of a Roman ambassador called Lucius Postumius Megellus who came to demand reparations from the Tarentines in 282 BC, shortly before the outbreak of the war against Pyrrhus of Epirus. When Megellus attempted to address the Tarentines in Greek, probably out of respect, they fell about laughing and mocked him. In fact, they treated him so contemptuously that, according to tradition, it was one of the causes of the ensuing war between Pyrrhus and the Romans. As Eric Gruen suggests, that was probably the first and the last occasion that any Roman would make an effort to address the Greeks in their own language in an official capacity for a very long time. Turning to writing, the historian Quintus Fabius Pictor, late 3rd century BC, wrote his annalistic history of Rome in Greek. He did so partly because he wanted to explain Roman policy to the Greeks, but partly too because it would not have made any sense to him to write a history in Latin, given its rudimentary development at this point. The process of elite Romans learning Greek seems to have gathered pace in the first half of the 2nd century BC. Scipio Aemilianus, leading Philhellene, as we've seen, knew Greek and was familiar with Greek literature. Though the Greek historian Polybius primarily had a Greek readership in mind, it's likely that he was also writing for Romans who knew Greek. Even so, Greek speakers among the Roman elite were still in the minority at this period. When an embassy of Greek philosophers spoke before the Roman Senate in 155 BC, they did so through a Roman interpreter. By the beginning of the 1st century BC, however, all that changed. Henceforth, bilingualism in Greek and Latin became the norm among educated Romans. Since most people spoke Greek in the eastern part of the empire, it was almost essential that diplomatic activity be conducted in Greek. It wasn't, however, until the time of Sulla's dictatorship, roughly 82 BC, that a rhetorician named Molon was permitted to address the Senate in Greek without an interpreter. We may safely assume, therefore, that by this point, most educated Romans understood Greek. True, 30 years later, Cicero writes, "There is always someone in the Senate who asks for a translator when anybody delivers a speech in Greek." But this is the exception that proves the rule, since it implies that only a very small, boorish minority couldn't now understand Greek among the senatorial class. So, how did elite Romans, and we are talking here exclusively of elite Romans, of course, Romans of the upper classes, come to learn Greek? Well, the simple answer is that they were taught it in primary school. Quintilian went so far as to recommend that Roman children should start learning Greek before Latin. He writes, I quote, "I prefer that a boy should begin with Greek because Latin, being in general use, will be picked up by him whether he wants to or not. While the fact that Latin learning is derived from Greek is further reason for him to be first instructed in Greek." It's interesting that Quintilian concedes here, unblushingly, so to speak, the greater antiquity of Greek culture. But there's more good stuff to come. He goes on, "I don't advocate that he should speak and learn only Greek for a long time, as is generally done." What was that you said, Quintilian? "Most Roman boys from good backgrounds," we're talking primarily about boys, of course, "spoke and learned only Greek?" Well, yes, that's exactly what he seems to be saying. For he continues, I quote, "The study of Latin ought therefore not to lag far behind, and in a short time it should proceed side by side with Greek." Well, it seems a bit preposterous, but he's a teacher himself, so he presumably knows what he's talking about. So then, one wants to ask the question, why? Why were so many Romans bilingual? I can detect four reasons. First, the most obvious one is that most teachers were Greek, so it was natural for them to conduct their classes in Greek, as the earlier quote from Cicero and Quintilian indicated. A second reason is that it marked a man as educated. Just as today, one sometimes hears English spoken by educated Greeks in their own country, in, say, fashionable Kolonaki Square in the heart of Athens. Conversing in Greek with a member of one's social circle was also a mark of intimacy. Julius Caesar's dying words to the assassin Marcus Brutus, "You too, child, kai sou technon," were allegedly delivered in Greek. They add poignancy being in Greek because they signify intimacy between the murderer and his victim. Thirdly, and this is closely tied to the second reason, if you knew Greek, then there were all those handy-dandy literary allusions that you could sprinkle into your conversation or into your correspondence in order to impress people. Just to give a couple of examples of this, when the Roman general Scipio Aemilianus is describing the sack of Carthage, Polybius has him quote Hector's lines to his wife Andromache, in which he foretells the sack of Troy. Again, when the emperor Caligula wanted to make the point that he saw himself in the role of an absolute monarch, Suetonius has him quote a line from Homer, "It is not good for there to be many rulers, rather let there be one." A justification, in other words, for autocracy. And finally, there were things that one could say in Greek that one simply couldn't say in any other language. As a result, and we have evidence for this in correspondence, an educated Roman seeking to express an idea with a very particular shade of meaning, flavour, and so forth, and failing to come up with a Latin word that would express the idea adequately, would use a Greek word instead, rather as many foreign words and phrases have become commonplace in English. Even so, there remained a certain resistance to the use of Greek in official and unofficial circles. The Emperor Tiberius, AD 14 to 37, was particularly exercised to prevent Greek being spoken in the Senate, although he was fluent in the language himself, permitted its use in the law courts, and even cross-examined witnesses himself in Greek. At the lower end of the social scale, prejudice against the Greek language must have been very much more entrenched. Writing half a century later or so, Juvenal in his sixth satire complains about wives who irritate their husbands by speaking in Greek. "Small faults," he says, "are acceptable in a woman, but," he goes on to say, "what is more objectionable than this is when a woman doesn't believe in her beauty until she's dolled herself up as a Greekling. And here he uses that racist slur that we've seen before, Greikula, little Greek woman, rather than as a native-born Tuscan or as an Athenian, rather than as a country maid. They jabber only in Greek. Their fears, their joys, their concerns, they pour all of this forth in Greek. They even make love in Greek. You could excuse hot young babes for this, but when you're knocking on 86 years of age, why are you still talking in Greek? When you mouth obscene words like zoe and psuche, you're using in public what should be kept in the bedroom. Well, what makes Juvenal's allegation somewhat bizarre is that the obscene words he refers to, zoe and psyche, are in fact perfectly harmless. They mean life and soul, respectively. He could surely have found some raunchy Greek words to cite as examples if he'd wanted to, which means that we can't be sure in the end whether Juvenal is A, railing at women, or B, merely mocking those who rail at women for speaking Greek. It's also worth noting that this passage isn't, of course, just about language. On the contrary, Juvenal is suggesting that facility in Greek is a sign of immorality and lasciviousness, which in turn feeds into the stereotype that the Romans had of the Greeks as a people who were themselves immoral and lascivious, the topic we explored in the preceding lecture. Scholars estimate that by the 1st century CE, there were more Greek speakers in the Roman Empire than Latin speakers, primarily because the Greek-speaking East was more populous. In fact, Latin was probably not being spoken as a first language, much outside Italy. And by Greek East, I mean everywhere east of the Adriatic, that's to say the whole of mainland Greece, all the islands of the Aegean, and the provinces of Asia, Syria, Judea, Cyrene, Egypt, and so on. Virtually the only people who spoke Latin as a first language in that whole vast expanse of territory were colonists from Italy, resident in that region, and members of the Roman army. The Greek language had been introduced to the hinterland of Asia and Syria, to Judea and Egypt, as a result of the conquests of Alexander the Great. The local languages had survived, but official business in all these regions was conducted in Greek. So when the Romans arrived, they represented just a tiny percentage of the population. And that, of course, is why the Gospels were written in Greek. And not just the Gospels, but also the letters of Paul. In fact, the entirety of the New Testament was written in Greek. Even St. Luke's Gospel, which was written primarily with a Roman readership in mind, was written in Greek. Incidentally, we don't know for certain what language or languages Jesus spoke. He probably spoke Aramaic as his first language, an ancient Semitic language related to Hebrew, because there are sentences in Aramaic ascribed to him that are preserved in the Gospels. He probably knew Hebrew, but we can't be absolutely certain. And he probably knew some Greek as well, because he conversed with people who didn't know Aramaic. Judea had become Hellenized. It was part of the empire of the Seleucids for a time. But it's far from certain that he knew much Latin, other than the odd word, probably. Jesus, in fact, was probably typical of many in the Greek East, having a native first language, some smattering of Greek, and just a few words of Latin. The Greek historian Dio, writing in the early 3rd century AD, claims that at this date, the Roman plebs were still bilingual. The turn in the tide occurred in the following century, when the empire split into two parts and the government was transferred to the east. The separation of the empire led to a gradual linguistic separation, and by the 4th century, few Romans could speak Greek, and a tradition of bilingualism that had lasted over half a millennium now finally came to an end. What about Greek speakers in the West? As I noted at the beginning of this lecture, Greek continued to be spoken in Italy after every other language that had been previously spoken in the region was eliminated by the spread of Latin. It was spoken along the coast of Italy, all the way from Cumae in the north to Tarentum in the south, and also in Sicily. Archaeologists have found Greek inscriptions in catacombs on the east coast of Sicily that date from 250 to 500 AD. By AD 700, however, it had all but died out, but not quite. In fact, Greek is still spoken to this day in the toe of Italy in the form of a mixture of ancient Greek and Byzantine Greek and Italian, which means that there have been Greek speakers in Italy for nearly 3,000 years, ever since Pithecusi, Ischia, was founded in the second quarter of the 8th century BC. The Greek and Latin languages continue to be potent forces in the world today, the former helping to define national identity, the latter being invested with a spiritual authority that helps the Catholic Church to spread its ecumenical message around the world. To conclude, this lecture has been about language. But language is not just about words. It's about power relations, as we noted at the beginning, and it's also about cultural interchange. In the course of the next three lectures, we're going to be looking at some of the most basic aspects of life for any culture: leisure and entertainment, sex and sexuality, death and burial. We will see that the fact that many Romans became bilingual and were therefore able to absorb Greek ideas was to have profound consequences on their approaches to and their thinking about these human universals, since in all three instances, a common Greco-Roman element is detectable.